Let me say it's very pleasant to be with you all once again. I'd take a few thoughts from John chapter 11 that we just read together, because it's such an uplifting chapter, isn't it? The seven sign, probably the most significant is the eight signs in John's Gospel, and particularly helpful perhaps at Darlington at present, because she's been faced with so much bereavement of late. What a wonderful message that here we have the power of God demonstrated so clearly in his son bringing back Lazarus to life again. But Jesus said what was happening there was, in verse 4 he says, it's all for the glory of God, that the Son of God might be glorified thereby. And that glory is witnessed, isn't it, in the power vested in him to conquer death, to bring a dead man back to life again. And I think as a summary of the chapter, verse 25 shouts at me when Jesus is talking with Martha, and he concludes, I am the resurrection and the life. He that believeth in me, though he were dead, yet shall he live. And how powerful that is, brothers and sisters, that he is the resurrection and the life. He is the one with power over death. It occurred to me that many people the world over of late have been perhaps dwelling on what Jesus said there in terms of the death of His Royal Highness, the Duke of Edinburgh, in many of the remembrance services and the funeral yesterday, of course. These words were brought to mind again. And when people of power and influence pass off the scene, as they all do eventually, inevitably the wider public are faced with these issues that often they prefer not to bring to the fore. Is there really hope after death? Are the dead transported to heaven, as so many religious leaders would persuade them? Where does the resurrection fit in for that sort of teaching? And perhaps people, because of the power of these situations, like the funeral yesterday, begin to realize that faith is so important. It's the only comfort, really, isn't it, when you're faced with the loss of one of your own family. We, as a people, are so blessed, aren't we, that we have this strong faith, like Martha and Mary in Bethany. Just reading verse 23, the assurance that Jesus gave to Martha, thy brother shall rise again. Martha says to him, I know that he shall rise again in the resurrection at the last day. Wonderful faith there, and comfort that comes through that conviction. Just going back to yesterday, Prince Philip's funeral was a fairly low-key affair, wasn't it? Numbers were reduced from 800 down to 30 family members. Perhaps it was how he would have wished it that he had that choice anyway. But it started me thinking about this issue of social distancing, as we call it nowadays. I was wondering if these sorts of restrictions that are imposed upon us through COVID-19, whether those social distancing requirements still applied in the days of Jesus. Because the people of Israel knew, didn't they, well enough, even from the days of Moses, that contact with death in any form, a dead person, a grave, even a human bone rendered a defilement upon them, a defilement that had serious consequences in the days of Moses, particularly. If you keep a finger on an author in John, just I want to take you back to Numbers, the book of Numbers, in chapter 5. Where we have the serious consequences of being in contact with that. We struggled through the book of Numbers, haven't we, for a number of weeks now, and probably like me at times, the requirements that were laid on the people seem very complicated and onerous, and perhaps we can, as we read, think, well, what is it to do with us? We don't follow these heavy restrictions at all. What are we learning from wading through a book like Numbers? But there are powerful lessons actually to be taken. But here is what God laid upon his people to teach them in Numbers 5 verse 1. The Lord spake to Moses saying, command the children of Israel that they put out of the camp every leper and every one that hath an issue and whoever is defiled by the dead, both male and female, shall we put them out. Without the camp shall we put them, and they shall not, that because they defile their camps in the midst whereof I dwell. And the children of Israel did so, and put them out without the camp, as the Lord spake to Moses, so did the children of Israel. So they realized well enough, didn't they, that separation and exclusion from fellowship was forced upon them through contact with death. And the reason for that was because death is the consequence of sin. And sin alienates from God. And God said he dwelt in the midst of their camp, and therefore these sad people had to be put out of the camp. And I think the saddest thing about that, brothers and sisters, was that these groups who were judged by the law to be unclean and had to be separated from all others were not actually helped at all by the law. The law convicted them, or condemned them to their fate, to their unfortunate situation. But really, it was of little or no help. All the usual sacrifices, the animal offerings, couldn't change matters for them. And you could well be thinking, well, that's not exactly true, is it? Because if you come forward to Numbers 19, you'll perhaps remember that God did make a provision to help certainly those who had been in contact with death. But it's not really something to do with the law. The law prescribed it, but it didn't find any solution within its own terms. I'll try and explain that as we go on. But you remember this, this strange procedure in Numbers 19, which we know as the red heifer arrangement. It's worth looking in a little detail at it in relation to John 11, which we'll go back to in a moment or two. But just reading the beginning of the chapter, the Lord spoke to Moses in the Aaron, saying, this is the ordinance of the law which the Lord hath commanded, saying, speak unto the children of Israel that they bring thee a red heifer without spot, wherein there is no blemish, and upon which neither came yoke. And you shall give her to Eleazar the priest, that he may bring her forth without the camp, and one shall slay her before his face. And you know what happened, that he used a little bit of the blood in verse 4 to sprinkle it towards the door of the tabernacle. And then the whole carcass of that animal was consumed by fire, and the ashes were used eventually to mix with water to provide some purification for those who had been in contact with death. Verse 9 tells us that a man that is clean shall gather up the ashes of the heifer and lay them up without the camp in a clean place, and it shall be kept for the congregation of the children of Israel for the water of separation. It is a purification for sin. So they use this strange mixture of the little ashes of this heifer that have been burnt in the fresh water, living water, ideally, to purify on the third day after contact with death, and then again on the seventh day. And if those arrangements were not followed or refused, then the consequences were very serious indeed. If you go down to verse 13, as whosoever touches the dead body of any man that is dead and purifies not himself, defileth the tabernacle of the Lord, and that soul shall be cut off from Israel, because the water of separation was not sprinkled upon him. He shall be unclean, his uncleanness is yet upon him. So it's desperate, isn't it? That person who refused cleansing in this ceremonial way remained unclean and separate from the rest of the community. And verse 20 actually repeats that. So serious was it. Now, I was wondering whether these laws or these procedures were still adhered to in the time of Jesus. We read how people going up to Jerusalem to keep the Passover went and purified themselves. So they were still aware, weren't they, of this idea of a legal defilement through misbehavior or through contact with death. But to what extent these rules were kept in the days of Jesus, it's very difficult to say, isn't it? But people like Martha and Mary needed some way to resume normal life after they'd buried their brother. Jesus arrived on the fourth day, didn't he? We read that, after Lazarus' death. But I'm not sure when this defilement had to be reckoned from. Was it from death or was it from the burial? Because contact with a grave rendered a person defiled as well. And a whole load of other little questions started revolving through my head as I pre-read John 11, thinking back to the link with the heifer. Where were the ashes stored? Where would Mary and Martha obtain this purification? Would they have to go to Jerusalem? Or was there a local way of meeting this requirement? And who would administer that sprinkling water to render them clean again? And why would the ashes of a heifer, such a strange animal, have such a powerful effect? You think just clean water would do. Why muddy the water with the ashes of the heifer and so on? And perhaps most importantly, what is God trying to teach by having people go through procedures like this? And it's not just for Israel, was it? Paul says the law was a schoolmaster to bring us to Christ, and he's talking to some Gentiles as well as to Jews. So there is teaching there for ourselves. So let's just think about this heifer. I suggested that it was a procedure that really wasn't part of the law. It was something separated from the offerings made to the tabernacle or later in the temple. Very different, isn't it? The normal animals were lambs and rams and bullocks and so on. Here it's a red heifer, female offering. What have we been shown? A heifer, of course, is a cow, usually a young cow, and I think it's a term that's used of a cow that has not yet calved. It's not had any offspring, it's not fulfilled its requirements, its natural function, we could say. comes out more in the Hebrew than in the English. The Hebrew for this heifer is fruit bearer. So that's its function, to bring forth more cattle, isn't it? It has to be a regular one, not a black and white, not a spotted, or speckled. Red in Hebrew is Adam. And so, it, in some way, it's linked with those descended from the first man, isn't it? There's a link to the human race there. Like the other animals, it has necessarily to be without spot and blemish. It has to be perfect. And finally, it comes back out other requirements at the end of verse 2 of Numbers 19, that it has never to have carried a yoke. It's never to have been forced into the work, the service. Now, when you start to think about those various details, those various aspects of this animal, quite powerful, aren't they? What it's telling us. Here's an animal that was taken in its prime, probably 3 years or under 3 years old, because Abraham was put amongst those offerings in Genesis 15 to take a heifer 3 years old. It's killed before it's produced any offspring, any fruit, and yet by its death, it was effecting a work that was vitally important to those who had been defiled by death, and consequently sin that brought that death. And it's a red heifer, presumably like our Hereford cattle, or something like that, that linked through its colour with Adam, the descendants of Adam. And it's an animal whose death is bringing to others a cleansing, and with it a change of life, really. It's bringing a renewed association with God, a reconciliation with God. Now, from our perspective, it's easy, isn't it, for us to look back on these things and see so many aspects of the work and character of the Lord Jesus Christ. But what about Israel being taught by these things? Much more difficult, wasn't it, for them? And yet, when you look at it, there were actually several pointers in this procedure that might have suggested to them that they were being helped here in the mercy of God by something that was not related to keeping the rules of the law, not associated with the sacrifices that they usually made on the brazen altar in the tabernacle and the temple. So it was something outside the law. It was not to do with observance of a set of rules at all, in the sense that it all happened outside the camp. You see what we read in verse 3, that this animal had to be given to Eleazar the priest, that he may bring her forth without the camp, and one shall slay her before his face. And then those ashes, after it had been consumed by fire, were stored up in a clean place outside the camp. There's that emphasis, and we'll come back to that in a moment again. The other point that must have struck people about this procedure was that there was no cost involved on a personal basis. Normally, if a person wanted forgiveness or acceptance again for something they've done wrong, they would take their own skin offering, or chastise offering, to the tabernacle doorway, wouldn't they? It would be an animal out of their own flock, and because it had to be the best, the conclusion I think many would jump to would be that, well, it's got to cost me something to obtain forgiveness. I've got to, in a way, pay for my fault. And that's not the case of the offering. It's not what the offerings are teaching at all, really, is it? It was the sacrifice of the life of the animal and the shedding of the blood that was important to provide forgiveness. It wasn't particularly the cost. But here was something that was free of charge because it was provided out of the nation for everyone. And many, many people benefited through the death of this one special animal taken out. The ashes would be used time and time again. But there's another point, isn't there? And he could easily miss it, especially because we weren't there and we didn't know about who was officiating. But in verse 3, we said that the animal had to be given to Eleazar, the priest. Those who were there would have thought, well, why not Aaron? Why, he was the officiating high priest. He was still alive and well. You see that from the end of the verse 28 of the previous chapter. So it was given to someone who wasn't high priest, but who would be high priest in the future. He's operating outside the camp as the elected, the high priest elect, shall we say. So you see, there were pointers to help people understand that this was something that God had arranged outside of the terms the normal operating procedure of approaching to him through animals offered in the tabernacle. And when we think about it, it's helpful, isn't it, to be taught the importance of this other way that God has devised for our acceptance, our reconciliation, our forgiveness, that it's outside something that we're providing. It's outside a set of rules as well. And if you go back now to John chapter 11, to pick up this idea of being outside, I just wondered as I was thinking through, are we seeing some of this outsideness in the events in John chapter 11? Quite a clumsy word there, I'm afraid. But Jesus delayed his arrival, didn't he, at Bethany purposely. He didn't want to arrive in time simply to heal Lazarus of his sickness. It wasn't a healing. The glory of God was going to be displayed by a resurrection, of dealing with death, much more important, much more significant. And secondly, when he arrived, he didn't actually go into the town, did he? He didn't go to the house that he was so familiar with in Bethany, where the death had occurred, and incidentally the house itself would have been polluted under the terms of Numbers 19. He stopped short of that. Martha then came out to meet him before he got to the house in verse 20. And then she had this awful discussion with him, criticizing him a little for not coming earlier. But after she's made her declaration there in verse 27, that she believed that he was the Christ, the Messiah, Son of God, which should come into the world, then in verse 28, when she's so sad, she went away and called Mary, her sister, secretly, saying, the Master is come and calleth for thee. Jesus didn't walk back into town with her as he would have expected. And as soon as that was 29, Mary arose quickly and came unto him. And John puts the point, now Jesus was not yet coming to the town, but was in that place where Martha met him. Now, I won't insist on the significance of that, but it's interesting, isn't it, brothers and sisters? The mourners who had gone to the house actually followed Mary out as well. Verse 31, the Jews then which were with her in the house and comforted her, when they saw Mary, that she rose up hastily and went out, followed her, saying, she goeth to the grave to weep there. I'm not saying, of course, that Jesus would in some way have been polluted or rendered ceremonially unclean himself by the proximity of those affected by death. He wouldn't, would he? In fact, if you think back to his ministry, the start of his ministry, it's obvious that he very decidedly went out of his way to deal with the problem that was that people whom the law had excluded, to help them out of that situation. He came down off the mountain, didn't he, having given the Sermon on the Mount, and he's met by a leper. And the leper says, Lord, if you will, you can make me clean. And the leper very carefully says that Jesus said, I will, and he touched him. I will, be thou clean, he said. And then, just a little later, he's met by the woman with the issue of blood, who knows she has to touch him. I can only just touch the hem of his garment, I shall be clean, I'll be healed. And they're on the way to the house of Lazarus, aren't they? And there he's going to deal with death. And the crowd are amazed when he says, the girl's not dead, she's asleep. And they're laughing to scorn. And he takes her by the hand. He got contact with death, but he's got power over death. And gives her back her life. So he dealt with those issues that condemned those people in Numbers chapter 5. Lepers, those were the issue of blood and the dead. And he was showing, wasn't he, that his righteousness and the power of God operating through him overcame these ritual defilements at all. He was undefiled and separate from sin. He could cope with these issues that so bring humanity down to sadness and despair. He was the red heifer without spot and blemish. I wonder if they saw that in going out to meet him, Martha and Mary, knowing that there was no help amongst these mourners in the house. They had to go out of the village to him. He was the one who could benefit many, like the heifer, by his untimely death. I don't think they fully understood that yet, but Mary did, didn't she? She'd anointed him and been complimented on it because she understood it was towards his death. He was the one that had never been yoked like the red heifer. He'd never been in bondage to sin. And he, of course, was the fruit bearer. No fruit as yet, but what a tremendous harvest will be realized through his saving work. He is that high priest represented by Eleazar, the high priest elect, after the order of Melchizedek, operating in a different system outside of the law. And the law only condemned people, didn't it? It didn't really help them. Although, as hopefully we can see, in other ways it steered people to the coming of this one who could answer all their problems. So, and probably raising more questions in your mind than answers, but they're interesting questions, aren't they? Because they're centered around this saving work of the one who we have touched and reached out to, because it's all our comfort, it's all that we are about, and it's all that we're hoping for. So I'll just close if we can now, just going further on to the letter to the Hebrews. Just a couple of quotations there that are so relevant to what we've been talking about. Hebrews chapter 9. This is where convention, if we can put it that way, is being overturned, isn't it? Hebrews 9 and verse 11. because Christ being there, because Christ being come and high priest of good things to come, a greater and more perfect tabernacle, not made with hands, that is to say, not of this building, not to do with the tabernacle or the temple, neither by the blood of goats and calves, but by his own blood, he entered in once into the holy place, having obtained eternal redemption. For if the blood of bulls and goats and the ashes of an heifer that we've been talking about, sprinkling the unclean, sanctify it to the purifying of the flesh, this ceremonial uncleanness, how much more shall the blood of Christ, who through the eternal Spirit offered himself without spot to God, purge your conscience from dead works to serve the living God? And that's why we come together, isn't it, to think about this one who achieved so much by his death. It's to hit our conscience, really, to look at our behaviour and our following and our works to serve our Lord God in heaven, because of what he achieved and what he was willing to do for us. Final quotation, Hebrews chapter 13. And going in at verse 10, like it says, we have an altar where they have no right to eat which serve the tabernacle. For the bodies of those priests whose blood is brought into the sanctuary by the high priest for sin are burned without the camp. Wherefore Jesus also, that he might sanctify the people, with his own blood, suffered without the gate. And here's the exhortation. Let us go forth, therefore, unto him, without the camp, bearing his reproach. Instead, how much they jeered at him for saying that Lazarus is only sleeping, or when he went to raise Jairus' daughter, and yet to put him after the room, wouldn't he? Because they couldn't accept his words, that she's only asleep. Such was the case to him, because he had such power over death. We bear some of that reproach for our beliefs, hopefully. Verse 14, for here we have no continuing city. We seek one to come, don't we? So, Those washings that we looked at were on the third and the seventh day, weren't they? The third day inevitably connects with the death of Jesus, didn't it? For Abram, when he was taking his son Isaac to Moriah, it was on the third day they saw that very significant spot. And Jesus was 3 days and nights in the heart of the earth, as Jonah was in the fishes belly and so on. So three, the washing on the third day linked with death, the sacrifice of Jesus. But it projects forth to the seventh, and God rested on the seventh day, the Sabbath, the new beginning on the eighth day, when these people were truly free of their contact with death. And it spoke of resurrection and entrance into a new life, didn't it? We, I suppose, week by week, are carrying not this symbolic washing. We come to remember the death and our connection with the death of our Lord and Savior. It's like that washing on the third day, isn't it? But we're looking forward to that ultimate cleansing and that resurrection, because of our washing on the seventh day, when we're clothed upon with immortality, and when this corruptible